I've got to say, LJ, I can't promise you that I'm not going to use your voice note in the actual episode.
Oh.
I can't rule it out, is all I'm saying.
And welcome to a wonderful episode of Somewhere in Between, the podcast for AITs and First Fives, brought to you by the RCGP. My name's Mira, and today I'm really lucky to be joined with a few familiar faces. We've got LJ, Hatim, and Kim. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey.
Sadly, Johannes couldn't be with us today, but he is sort of WhatsApping us all in our group, reminding us that he's very much here and wanting to meet us all soon. And of course, it wouldn't be a Somewhere in Between podcast episode without having producer Bryn in the background. Hey, Bryn.
Not going to make me talk on air, are you? Surely not.
It's a podcast exclusive. Now you all know he's real. So this week we have brought you an excellent episode. Actually, I have to say Kim has brought us an excellent episode. A few weeks ago, she went and chatted to Paul O'Reilly, who is a GP who has an interest in homeless health and homeless medicine and works in a practice in Westminster. I don't think we need to do much more than that. I think we just need to sit back and listen to Kim's debut interviewing Paul O'Reilly.
So Paul, do you want to introduce yourself?
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. Well, my name is Paul O'Reilly. We run a general practice called the Dr. Hickey Surgery, which is specifically for homeless people in the south of Westminster. We have about 2,300 registered population. And I've been doing this now for the best part of about the last 20 years. And I'm now totally de-skilled from doing anything else. So I'm sure this will be what I do until I get carried out. I think the first and most important thing I'd want to say is this is the best thing I've ever done in my life. It is just everlastingly, every day, enjoyable. I came into it, I was originally a very unhappy kidney doctor for a couple of years and wondering where this was all going to. And I just decided I had to stop doing that. It wasn't going anywhere for me. And I went back to college for a time, and I started just as a voluntary job on a Wednesday afternoon, going to serve in this practice here. And gradually I discovered that the days I was going to work here, I was leaping from my bed in the mornings. At the time the alarm clock went off, looking forward to going to work and being on time when I got there. I'm thinking, this has never happened to me before. So when I did my obs, you know, pulse and blood pressure normal, I thought, well, this is obviously telling me something. And to be frank, it's been that way ever since. Because, and I've always had to find this difficult to explain to people, but fundamentally we all joined to make it better in some sense or another. I mean, I know we said this in our medical school interviews, but there was a bit of it that was true. We really want to see people doing better as a result of a process that we're involved with. And nowhere in my life have I seen that work better than in homeless medicine. It's not that our people don't have things wrong with them, they have a lot wrong with them. But the great thing is there is so much you can do using reasonable medical technology that really makes a difference. And there's nowhere else that the concept of general practice, building a relationship with people and using that relationship appropriately, not abusively or manipulatively, just using that relationship to help them to get to better outcomes medically. That's just what happens. And it happens every day. And every day I go home a happier man as a result of my day at work. And I can't describe to you how that makes me feel.
Oh, it's so nice to hear someone who, because obviously, that you know, the world of GP at the moment is challenging, isn't it? And it's so nice to hear someone who just loves their job.
Yeah, I spent 8 years being an LMC chair for Kensington Chelsea Westminster. So inevitably, you know, you're the complaints desk of general practice. You know, you're the person that GPs come to when they're having a shitty day, or somebody being horrible to them. So you sit them down, and it's almost like that interview you have with a relative when you work in a hospice and somebody's died. And then within 2 minutes, you just let them talk. They start talking about their own grief. And in the same way, I discovered that when colleagues came to me, the first 2 minutes would be about the CCG being horrible to them, the GMC being horrible to them, whoever it was being horrible to them. CQC often figured quite heavily in that. And if you just let them go on, quite quickly they would get to their own grief at not any longer being able to do what they really wanted to do when they came into the job, which is see people and have them leave them a little bit better, or at least a little bit more reassured, or a little bit more comforted than when you met them.
Oh.
And there was all this other stuff that was now getting in the way of the actual job. I don't need to detail that. Because it's horrid. Okay, that is part of my life, but it's only a small part of my life, because most of my life is getting to do the job we all wanted to do, which is see people, do something for them, or perhaps better with them, and help them to find a better way in their lives. And it is just so everlastingly rewarding.
Fantastic. So am I right in that your practice only do homeless medicine?
That's right. To be honest, I wouldn't be safe seeing anybody who wasn't homeless. because it's a different world. It's a different skill set. Fundamentally, general practice isn't being about being an expert in any particular disease or any particular treatment or any particular, but it's about trying to be an expert in a particular group of people.
And
that's true of every GP. You just try to be as expert as you can be about this particular group of people, that's your practice population. So I like to think that I know this 2,300 people better than anybody else does.
So that's how many people are in your practice.
Outside that.
Yeah, so you've got 2,300 homeless patients on your register.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. And how many GPs do you have in your practice?
Well, as of the 1st of April, we now have 4 partners.
Amazing.
On the 1st of April, we had the one. But I've had 3 colleagues join me. I'm trying amongst my PCN colleagues to explain that these are actually new signings and holding up the shirt. The 3 of them have actually been working with me for a grand total of 30 years between them. It's difficult to introduce them as quite new blood, but we've now been able to bring them through and give them the kind of reassurances they need to be able to enter into partnership. And they're all younger and better looking than me. So thank goodness this is radio. So hopefully that kind of guarantees the future of the practice into the future.
Oh, fantastic. And so tell me, Paul, how is your practice different to other practices? What is it that your practice does how is your day different to kind of any other practice?
Day different. We're just rigged to be for homeless people.
Mm.
So every decision, every choice we make should be about how can we be the best practice we can be. So that starts with access. Because our people aren't the sort of people who are going to be able to ring up, make an appointment for 3 weeks' time, come in with a nicely ordered story about their symptoms, how their symptoms started, how they progressed, and make a few suggestions as to what they'd like done about them. That doesn't happen. Well, maybe once in the year, but that doesn't happen. Our people rock up, and my senior partner, unfortunately now retired, Mary Hickey, used to always say, what is typical of our people is the unreasonable presentation of the entirely reasonable request. So our people will come in, bang on the side, oh, I want to see the doctor! which is fine. And our people are used to that. So our receptionist, rather than phoning the police, will say, very good, Sam. Dr. Wilkins, Dr. O'Reilly, we'll see you very shortly. Please take a seat. Would you like a cup of tea? And we'll say, oh, and sit down and have a cup of tea. And then you'll meet them. And then they'll have calmed down a bit. And then you'll be able to do, because once the waiting room experience works, the catecholamines drop a bit and you're able to do business.
Brilliant. And so do you have an appointment system at all then, or is it all just walk-ins?
Sort of. Up until COVID, we were pretty much all walk-in. Mm. But COVID had to change us. We did almost no remote consulting prior to COVID. Now, because so many more of our patients do actually have phones, because the outreach services now give them out, you know, little old-fashioned Nokia-type things, the cheap burner phones, we can now do a little more remote consulting, which is great because it expands our reach.
Yeah.
Also, it's quite a bit more convenient for a lot of our people. Because our people obviously don't have access to transport. So they have to, either they have to walk or they have to bunk a bus or a train.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's stuff that they can be done over the phone, then that's good for them too. So we've now moved to a bit more of a mixed economy, whereby we're about half walk-in C and about half over the telephone or the remote meeting. We occasionally get to do video phones, but smartphones are rare as hen's teeth in our lot, so very often. But that's always the adaptation we have to make. We turn over probably about a third of our population every year. So it's a very moving population. And there's always another way. It's always different. And it's always different to the last group of homeless people. And they always come with a slightly different set of needs and requiring a slightly different set of practice response. So it's a bit like Madonna. You have to reinvent yourself every 4 years.
Just to meet their needs. And have you found that the number of people on your books has increased quite significantly over the last few years? Or is it steady?
No, actually. I have to say, the last 2 years have been the best 2 years of my life.
Oh.
Because of COVID, or perhaps more specifically, because of the policy response to COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, our people, by and large, didn't have a problem with COVID as a disease. I mean, there's plenty wrong with them, but by and large, they don't have the age or the other comorbidities that make them particularly vulnerable to COVID. So COVID hardly affected them at all. I think we maybe had one attributable death over 2 years. However, the policy response, the lockdowns, changed their world entirely. Because, particularly the first lockdown, which was very strict, central London was a ghost town.
Yeah.
And so all the major ways in which our people make money were closed off to them. Begging, nobody to beg off. Shoplifting, no shops open. And what is politely known as the nighttime economy wasn't functioning either.
Mm.
So as a result, the whole demand side of the drugs and alcohol economy collapsed. As did the supply side, because suddenly all those little boats coming across from Holland were getting a lot more scrutiny than they were used to.
Mm.
And the dealers, well, if they stood out in a street corner, all they had for company was all these large chaps dressed in blue, who they didn't particularly see eye to eye with. So the dealers didn't fancy catching COVID any more than anybody else did, so they weren't good. So the supply side of the economy collapsed as well. So suddenly, there was no drugs and alcohol economy. So we had all these people coming to us to help them manage their addictions.
Wow, so interesting.
And the other big plus was, of course, the much trumpeted Everyone In project. Now, we all thought cynically, oh, well, this is just the Tories' way of bailing out their pals in the hotel industry. but there's never a bad reason for doing a good thing. An enormous number of our population saw this for what it was, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to break the cycle.
Yeah.
And loads of them got in, And one of the really nice things about that was I was talking to some of the workers who didn't at all share their owner's enthusiasm for having their nice hotel invaded by all these rough, smelly people. But a few days after they'd started doing this, they had a chat with me. He says, "God, these are so much nicer than the people I normally have to deal with." That was cool. And the other nice thing was there was the collapse of the private rental sector.
Yeah.
Just that they got into the hotels for that time, but they then got moved out of the hotels into permanent accommodation really quickly. Because lots of renters were now accepting people on benefits, which they weren't before. And so we must have lost about 300 people to wellness over the course
of... Oh, wow. What a lovely way of putting it. Yeah.
So cool. And I mean, obviously, normality is beginning to creep back in. But what's nice, we haven't seen those people back.
Okay.
And we were, old and cynical and grey-haired. We thought, soon as lockdown's over, soon as the major crisis is over, as soon as the footfall is back in London, it'll be... No. But so much has gone back to normal that those people, by and large, haven't come back. And that it's made a permanent difference in their lives. That's so cool.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, long may it continue. I hope that continues. But I do share a bit of your cynicism, but let's cross our fingers.
Absolutely.
Well, am I right in thinking that you do outreach work as well as a practice?
Yes, quite a lot. Because, obviously, at a homeless practice, you need to be at least as interested in the people who don't come and see you as those who do. Because, by and large, the people who don't come and see you, it isn't because they've not got enough wrong with them.
It's because
they've got too much wrong with them. And therefore, in many respects, you want to be doing as much as you can. So we run lots of outreach. We run about 8 sessions in our local hostels. We've got a couple of sessions into our 2 major local day centres. In fact, I've just come back from there now. And we also do some street outreach sessions. In fact, I was on one last night. You just go out in the evening with the outreach workers who are paid to do this for a living. They identify the people who are most in need, and you go out and you register them and you meet I suppose what you really want to do is do enough to show that there's something you can do for them that makes it worth their while to come in.
Yeah.
So, what's the name? 15 or 20 people last night, registered 3 new people, gave them some medicines and saw some, saw 2 or 3 of those back in today immediately. And that's always very encouraging because it means that you can see that visible movement from the street and people coming to know the opportunity. And it's also really important we do that because even if you hardly see anybody, you don't see anybody new or don't particularly do anything, what you're still doing is you're getting the message to people that there is an option. Because more than a third of people who are homeless that you will meet are new to being homeless.
Okay.
I'm going to make a presumption here that if, let us say, you alienated everyone in your life today, such that there was nobody in the world who was going to offer you a bed for the night, I have a feeling that you probably wouldn't know where to go to get a safe place to sleep. You wouldn't know where to go and get a sleeping bag. You wouldn't know where to go and get food, get drink, get a toilet, get a shower, try to be as nice and clean and sweet-smelling as you want to be. And all of those things, let alone where to get some medicine or indeed where to get some advice about some benefits or indeed some advice about where you're going to be able to get some accommodation to get out of this mess you've managed to work yourself into, or perhaps somebody to help talk through and broker some of those relationships that you screwed up in a moment of madness. so it's really important that we get our message out there before all those other people who have other messages to offer you who are having that plea in your ear.
Very true. No, you're right. I can't imagine how difficult it is when you all have very quickly end up in a situation such as that. And you've literally lost everything that you had. It must be quite frightening initially.
Even someone of your personal resources would struggle. So yeah. Someone with perhaps less personal resources, it's going to be tough.
It is. Okay.
And so it's really important that we're trying to meet them halfway as much as possible.
Yeah. So what do you think, obviously you're a practice that specialise in homeless medicine, but what do you, those practices that may have homeless people on their books as such, or what do you think the rest of us can do better at in terms of managing those who are homeless?
Fundamentally, what homeless people want more than anyone else is just someone who'll be vaguely nice to them. Mm-hmm. And offer them the same service that they get from it, that would be given to anyone else. And one of the problems is that our people so frequently manifest fear in the form of anger. I once had it put to me by a colleague who also works in homeless medicine. Our people approach the doctor the same way a GP approaches their bank manager. They know this is a terribly important moment in their lives, that it may or may not go well, and that somehow they need to say the right things and keep calm and not say anything that will destroy the conversation.
So true, yeah.
They are much more scared of us than we are of them. Mm-hmm. But the difficulty is that because they can present in a scary manner, it's difficult to remember that, because if they're scared, they will look scary. If we get scared, then we look scary. And then this doesn't end well.
Yeah.
So if it's at all possible, when you meet that, you're going to do that Roger Neighbor thing. I don't know if even Roger Neighbor is still a concept in general. but it's a kick back and just see if you can give them the first 2 minutes of the consultation, just to use in whatever way they want to use.
Okay. Oh no, that's really great advice actually. And if you find someone who's homeless who comes into your waiting room sort of demanding appointments, I've read places before that we should, where possible, try and accommodate them sort of in terms of, and I know a lot of practice don't do walk-in services anymore, but what are your thoughts on that?
You can do it. That's great.
Yeah.
If it is simply unfeasible for you, then it would be really helpful to know if there's another practice in your area that is able to work in a way that helps that. Our PCN colleagues have little compunction about redirecting patients to us, as little compunction as we have in directing our cardiology to them.
Yeah.
I think it's really important that, particularly as secondary care really isn't working anymore, that we utilize the specialist resources we have in general practice in order to help one another and identify which patients are as appropriate as possible for which practice. And I think PCN working really helps that, because it does allow practices and individual GPs to develop their specialist interest. And I think that's going to become increasingly important. And obviously we need to create the mechanisms that allow inter-practice referral in a really good way, and indeed attach a cash value to it.
Yeah.
LMC chair, always an LMC chair. No, we need to be able to generate, to make sure that there's an income stream that comes with that additional work that then enables general practice to grow and to thrive.
Yeah, and to meet people's needs effectively, yeah.
And now that PBR is gone, secondary care is always going to be this way.
Mm.
It's not going to get better.
That's an interesting point, actually, about secondary care. And I was just thinking back to patients who, these patients are often quite dysfunctional and are often chaotic lives. How do you manage that in terms of trying to get them seen in secondary care when they don't have money to get transport, when all of, you know, all of these things working against them? How do you as a practice manage that?
Well, I'm extremely fortunate in that there are a lot of services for homeless people in Westminster. We have the largest rough sleeping population in the country. So that in some respects, that's natural. But in each borough, there will be some kind of homeless service. There will be some kind of outreach service. There will be some kind of support services. And so and I realize that I'm speaking from a position of wealth in this. We happen to have a lot of very good hospitals in our area, in particular St. Thomas's. I think they need a particular shout out because in the course of the time I've been here, they have gone from being the worst place to send a homeless person to being the best.
Oh, wow. That's good.
They have their, and that didn't happen by accident. They developed what's called a pathway program. I don't know why they have the name, but that's a service within the hospital that's specifically for homeless people. So they can identify homeless people, they can work with them, they can enable them to make the best use of their hospital stay. They can try and talk them down when they're getting scared of this big, white, horrible building with all these beeping machines and people running around looking terribly busy, and it's all a high catecholamine environment that they don't feel comfortable with.
Yeah.
They can give them a fiver to put on the television to give them something to not get too bored about. They can make sure that the medicines that they're on in the hospital are the same as the ones they were meant to come in with, as opposed to what the ward pharmacist thought they ought to be on. And they can also make sure that we get the discharge summary on the day the patient comes out, because the first place they'll come is us.
Yeah.
And so we need to get that. So we need to get the discharge summary at the moment that the patient hits the road.
Yeah.
In order that we can, and they can do that for us. How cool is that?
That is great. That is a great example of joined up working, which is what we aspire to, isn't it?
No more of this Friday night standard. You know, somebody comes in on some green ones, some blue ones, and some brown ones.
Yes.
And they need some more right now because they didn't pick them up from the hospital pharmacy. Well, sir, I think you'll find the green ones are your omeprazole, and it'll be fine.
Oh, no, that's great. So, it's been so interesting listening to kind of your passion for this area of medicine and how it's sort of just, it's really been your, and how much you love your job. So can you think of a kind of pinnacle moment in your kind of all your years of looking after patients who are homeless where you, that you're really proud of or that you particularly remember? Sorry to put you on the spot. I haven't given you any preparation time for this.
No problem. I was telling this story last night to my outreach partner.
Okay.
A little bit long, but yeah, barely. I said I was on the LMC. Well, we had this Portuguese couple. Let's just call them Pedro and Maria, not their real names. And Pedro and Maria met in rehab somewhere, I think somewhere in Portugal. And they came out of rehab together, hand in hand. They're going to do really well together. But it wasn't a good time economically in Portugal. But Pedro knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody who ran a restaurant in Reading. And so they went to Reading. And he did the chefing, she did the waitressing, and it was all fine. And then, unfortunately, after a couple of years, recession comes even to Reading. So lost the job, lost the accommodation went with the job, relapsed. Like a lot of people who relapsed, went down really quite quickly. And they wound up on a little piece of grass right outside New Scotland Yard. And we met them on outreach, got them back, scripted to their methadone, titrated beautifully, but there they sat. And there was nobody who could help them. Didn't have the right tickets to have recourse to public funds, couldn't get into any hostels, couldn't get in anywhere. And finally, I came across a little pilot of a Housing First project. And I called the guy, I happen to know, he's a good friend of mine. And I said, these people never come and see you. Please go and see them. They're under the second tree from the right in this piece of ground. And he did, that night. And he arranged what could be a good flat for them. And so the following day, they walked to Walthamstow and fell in love.
Oh.
Not just with their flat. And the next and the following day, they came back to see me for their scripting appointment. And Pedro proposed to Maria.
Oh.
And was accepted.
In the middle of your practice?
In the, well, towards the end of the consultation.
Oh, this is fantastic.
It was done. And a contribution was made to the wedding from a small fund we have in the practice for items not normally funded.
Oh, I love this.
The story does not stop there.
Okay.
4 or 5 years later, I think it must have been. As chair of the MC, and it doesn't happen now, but in the old days we used to have an annual dinner in the Dorchester Hotel. it was a bit of a beery and boozy affair and a bit loud and messy and horrible, and if I'm honest, I didn't altogether enjoy it, but on this day it so happened that I was handed my plate by Maria, who had now moved up in the world of waitressing.
No way, really?
And that, I have to say, made my evening.
Oh my goodness, that was not where I thought that story was going.
Pedro gave up the chefing. He was a few too many temptations there. So he now works in construction. And they're doing all right.
Wow, are you still in touch with them?
Well, no, they've moved on. I haven't seen them for years, which is the right way.
In your business. Oh, what a story. That was a great story. Thank you so much. Wow. So this podcast is aimed at GP trainees, but also people in their first 5 years post CCT. And what would you say to anybody interested in perhaps pursuing sort of homeless medicine or somebody that wants to come and test it out? How can they get involved? What can they do and why should they do that?
Come and do some locums. And you'll either love it or hate it. It's not for everybody. For some people, it is a bit scary. It is a bit frightening. It'll be totally different to anything you've ever done before. You'll feel completely de-skilled and you'll feel completely out of your depth.
Okay.
And you know, people will come in with 20 things wrong with them, and you have no idea where to start. And if you're able to let go of that and work your way through it and do one thing that makes them a little bit better, you will then get the bug. But it is Marmite. It's not for everybody.
Yeah.
We've had people come do one local with us and then kindly, gently but firmly declined ever to darken our doors again. And we get that. It's simply not for everybody. But if it's your bug, if it's your thing, you will never want to do anything else ever again.
Oh, that's fantastic. And in terms of GP trainees who might be interested in getting a bit of experience, are they able to come and join you?
Always welcome. We do actually get some medical students now and again, but obviously we always want to preach the gospel and to make sure that other people have had this experience. Because the great thing is, I think one of the things that kills homeless people's experience of medicine is, if you'll forgive the jargon, the therapeutic nihilism. That we've all had experiences of meeting people we just kind of know in our little heart of heart we're not going to be able to help, and it's not going to go well. It's going to end up as a failed consultation, and I just can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
And once, if you ever get beyond that feeling of this isn't something I can do, because that's what they've got as well.
Mm.
They've got the feeling this isn't something I can do. This is not for me. once you can get beyond that feeling and knowing that you've done one thing right for them, and that's all it takes to make them your new best friend.
Oh.
Because they're not used to having anything done right for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they've got 20 things wrong with them, surely to God there's something you can fix.
One of 20, you'd hope so, wouldn't you?
Quite good odds, really.
But you're right, then I guess you fix one thing, you sort of gain their trust, yeah. And you start that kind of relationship.
And the other question people often ask me is, what do you do when you meet people on the street? To which the answer is, it's an answer, you give them the time of day. Mm. Just to have that space in which they can simply speak, because they don't get that very much.
No.
I do remember one of mine, she'd moved out way out. I think it was Hertfordshire she'd moved out to. But she still wasn't in accommodation. And she was still trying to come down and see us. And it was a long way to come. And I was saying, look, you really need to move on and get a local GP. I mean, it can't be right for you coming all this way down here. It's not that we don't like you. You know, it's just, it's got to be better for you. And she said to me, these are the only clothes I have. I haven't had a bath for a week. Would you go to a wedding the way I am? No, I get your point.
Mm.
Stay for a wee bit longer until you're just fixed up a bit more.
Yeah. Oh, Paul, it's been an absolute delight to talk to you. You've made me want to come and join you for some shifts and getting some experience of homeless medicine. Because as you say, I'm sure it is Marmite. You either love it or you hate it. But what a great way to try and kind of, you know, diversify as a GP. And if you're feeling a bit stuck in a rut and feeling kind of like this isn't for you, going and trying something different that fundamentally kind of is what we all went into medicine for.
So just one last thing, if I may.
Yes, absolutely.
I used to think that Westminster was the capital of homelessness. It's the capital of rough sleeping, true. But there is homelessness in every borough in London. Because statutory homelessness is quite broad. It includes people who are in temporary accommodation, it includes people who are vulnerably housed, all kinds of things. The biggest, actually, in terms of statutory homelessness is Brent. The second biggest is Kensington and Chelsea. Would you believe that?
No, God.
Is everywhere, because poverty is everywhere.
Mm.
And homelessness is a disease of relationships and poverty. It's what happens when nobody in the world will give you a bed for the night and you've got no resources personally to fall back on. So there is homelessness wherever you are. Wherever you are in the country, it might take a little bit of looking for, and it might take a little bit of openness in how you approach the people, or indeed allow the people to approach you. But it exists, it's out there, and there are some very needy people who we can fix. We have, but by and large, they don't have anything very sophisticated wrong with them. It's just that they're not getting access to the services that everybody else takes for granted.
Yeah. What a message to leave on. And it reminds me actually of a talk I went to by the King's Fund recently that we're talking about, you know, poverty is a disease, it's treatable and it's curable. And we all need to, you know, as NHS, kind of working in the NHS, take more of an interest in it.
But just over the last few years, we've proved that homelessness is treatable. We cured 30 or 300 of them.
That was a great statistic that you've that your numbers dropped during that time, and actually that's a sign that things got better. So I hope that continues. Paul, thank you so much for such an inspiring kind of really inspirational kind of interesting lovely talk, a lovely chat, basically. It's been like chatting to, I could chat to you all day, but we probably should wrap this up because it's so that people aren't listening for longer than kind of they need to. But I can't thank you enough. Thank you so much. Are you okay if we leave your, are you all right to, if we give your email address, we often put it on the end of the podcast, just so that people can contact you if they're interested in.
Yeah, though as you know, to your own cost, I'm not the world's best at responding to emails, but I shall do my best. I shall do my very, very best.
Oh, bless you. No, don't worry. I hopefully you won't be overwhelmed, but I think if you, there may be some interested people who are very interested in learning more about kind of your area of specialism ultimately, and I'm sure they'd love to come and maybe perhaps shadow you or join you or come and indeed come and try out some locum shifts. Oh, have you got any last words of wisdom, Paul?
Well, just say thank you, Kim, for giving me this opportunity to go on about the subject I care about the most in the world.
Oh, no, thank you for joining us and inspiring us to kind of look outside the box of what we think kind of GP is and go and find our thing that interests us. Because I think that's a big message on this as part of this podcast is that there are lots, you know, the GP is a gift of a CCT, which you can do a lot with. And this is just one example. So thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
Thank you so much, Paul. Take care.
Go well.
Thanks to everyone for listening to that. I mean, I was riveted from start to finish. And LJ, I know that from your voice note of us bookending this episode, you really enjoyed that too. But before we sort of have a big debrief of how amazing that was, Kim, how did it feel doing your first interview for the podcast?
Oh, well, I have to admit, I was a little bit nervous, but Paul was such a lovely guy. So I feel like we got through it together and he was an absolute delight to kind of talk to. I could have sat and talked to him for hours about his experiences of running a GP practice entirely dedicated to homeless patients and homeless people. So, yeah, what an amazing guy. It was an absolute pleasure to talk to him.
Absolutely. And I think it just goes to show that there are GPs that actually really do everything. There's lots of different things that we can set our hats to. You probably may have heard some of our episodes on education and leadership, greener practice, all sorts of different things. If you haven't, have a listen, gentle plug. But this is just an aspect of general practice that I didn't actually really know that much about. And to be honest, before I heard Paul to really talk about it, it's probably not something that I would have paid that much attention to, really. Although, as he did discuss, it is a big problem in the UK, especially in every borough in London, but also far more reaching than that in all four nations. LJ, I can see you nodding with me there. And I suspect you might have made a couple of notes. So go and share with us. What were your thoughts on the episode?
So I suppose the thing that struck me the most from sort of the beginning and all the way throughout was how important language was to Paul and the words that he used to describe his patients and his work. I know in the middle, Kim picked up on him saying that the phrase, "we've lost patients to wellness." And I thought that was really lovely to hear, just the way how he described how, you know, the patients in the practice would move on once they were no longer homeless. And that was a positive thing. And I think when we think and speak about homeless medicine, it's with apprehension. It's not quite sure how we approach it. We're a bit nervous about it. Maybe we try and avoid it if we can, just because we're nervous and we don't know how to deal with it. And actually, in so many other ways, the words and the language that we use is really important. And I think that really struck me through the podcast. I wonder what other people thought about the words he used and the language.
Yeah, I really liked the way he really put things across, spoke about the people that he serves and told the stories around their lives. Like, he really invested in his kind of community. And also, he was just so passionate, and you know, that really enthusiasm just really comes across. And when you've, you know, when you, it's very rare that you get that kind of enthusiasm in clinical practice. It's really nice to see. And we have a homeless register of the patients that we have in our practice, and we discuss them at every clinical meeting, but I wasn't aware that practices that purely just manage homeless people, and that, so that was quite a new revelation for me as well.
Yeah, and I think a thing that struck me, one, absolutely Hatem, as you mentioned, his passion. You know, he said, I'm doing a job that I love and I wake up every day and I want to go and do that. Now, frankly, I don't know if there's ever a day that I'll feel like that completely, fully, 100%. But there is something to be said about, you know, he said he started off as a kidney doctor and then has kind of wound his way up to something that he loves. And I think that's a really important message to people who are listening, who are trainees, but also in their first five, is just because you have potentially chosen a path or think that you're going to do something, that's maybe not what you're going to end up doing in 20 or 30 years time. In fact, it's a bit of a transition phase for a few of us in the podcast. Kim is due to CCT in about a week's time, and Johannes and I not far off. But Kim, homeless health locums in your future, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, how can you not be inspired by Paul and his experiences over the last few years? Like, it's not, homeless medicine is not something I have ever got to experience as a medical student, and as he mentioned, actually, the only time you often experience homeless patients is when you're finding them quite challenging in the middle of secondary care, which is obviously not a great environment for them at all. So I've never really truly kind of looked after patients from the primary care side, apart from the, you know, perhaps, you know, within my GP practice, where we're perhaps not as set up to deal with homeless people in terms of, you know, allowing them access and being a bit more flexible in terms of the way we work. So I think I'd definitely love to go and join Paul for some shifts just to see exactly, you know, how they do it and how we can all get better at it, given the rising problem of homelessness across the UK. I thought it was really lovely the way he talked about Guy's and St Thomas's and how they went from being one of the worst places in terms of looking after homeless patients to one of the best. And so, you know, you can change. And I think we've all got a lot to learn, I think.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think it's also echoed in the fact that it wasn't something really covered in my curriculum at all. But actually knowing how prevalent homelessness is. So whilst I was listening to Kim talk to Paul, I kind of wanted to know what was going on. So I looked on the shelter website and some interesting, quite scary statistics out there. So as of, you know, December 2021, shelter did a survey and sort of did a report. An analysis, and it said that 274,000 people in England are homeless, with thousands more likely to lose their homes. Now, bearing in mind that was back in December, we are now in a cost of living crisis. Lots of people are struggling to make ends meet. No doubt you're probably speaking to patients in your primary and secondary care settings who don't know where their next meal may be coming from. We know COVID really broadened that health inequality, that gap really widened, you know, people's reliance on food banks and resources, people who had never really had to use resources before. But, you know, putting that into perspective, you know, 274,000, what does that kind of mean? It's one in every 206-ish people in England are currently without a home. And that really brought it home, you know, listening to what he's saying, is that it is a missed population. It's a very vulnerable population. And although, as Paul said, you know, actually lots of them weren't as vulnerable to COVID because they didn't have all the other comorbidities, they're vulnerable to a lot of other health problems. But I do wonder whether it's something that's really being talked about in the education sphere in terms of medical students and other things going on. LJ, I know you've got a hand in that in terms of homeless medicine, homeless health. Is that much that you come across your students asking about or anything like that at all? Or not really?
Not really at all. And I think that the only time I've ever really thought about it is when I lived in a different city, not London, but a different city in the UK. And I remember seeing sort of people like sleeping on the street and things in the main high street. And I did think, I wonder where they go for their like healthcare. And I thought that maybe fleetingly for about 5 minutes as a doctor, and then never really thought about it again. So it's definitely something that we don't really address probably very well in undergraduate education. And then when you're working as a trainee, like when you're an F1, F2, when you're an SHO as a GP trainee in hospital, like you said, it's, you know, you might be faced with somebody who happens to be homeless, but that's pretty much your only real exposure to these patients, really. And I think that's probably a massive missed gap.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, thinking about sort of my experience with homelessness teams or the pathway that they say Guy's and St Thomas's minds with the homelessness team at King's, and as Kim said, you know, this is usually point of call in A&E when somebody comes in and actually maybe their biggest issue is potentially not healthcare related, but is social and poverty related, which in effect is a health problem. But also in the mental health spheres, lots of people who come in under section have often become homeless as a result of their ill health. And it's access to simple things. So, you know, yes, of course, where are they going to sleep at night? Is that safe? Are they not vulnerable from other people? But also access to phones, you know, something as simple as that at the time where we're doing so many remote consultations, where's that gap in the people that we're really not reaching? And Hatem, as our resident digital techie expert, I guess it's something to bear in mind, isn't it? We really laud all the new technological advances that have come as a result of COVID into primary care, but maybe there is a risk sometimes of not recognizing the people that might need healthcare the most that don't have access to that tech.
Yeah, so, I mean, choice exclusion is obviously a key factor, and I think we have to consider the role of the technologies that we use and how they might remove access for certain people. But interestingly, I have been, I've obviously done a lot of learning in this space, and there's one story that was told to me about a patient that that was homeless that actually, since the introduction of teleconsulting and remote consulting and e-access, suddenly started accessing their practice. So beforehand, they just wouldn't want to go see the GP because they felt prejudiced by having to be in the room with their GP, and they never felt they had received good care. And in the midst of the pandemic, they suddenly found that they could just fill out these online forms when they needed some advice and some support, and could have a telephone conversation with a doctor. And they felt that was much more comfortable for them because they weren't being seen. They didn't feel they were being prejudiced as much. So whilst it can also be a barrier to access, sometimes it can be a way to support access as well. So it's really interesting in terms of how we properly understand that. And I think if we could, most surgeries have a list of their homeless patients. I think it'd be nice if this might be good for some of our early career GPs trainees to do a bit of a service improvement project to perhaps even understand, you know, what is the ability of those patients to access services? Are the current access requirements appropriate for those patients? And then what could be done to support their access into the practice? That could be a really nice service improvement project.
Definitely. And I think there is also scope to work, you know, with your local hospital's homeless team or pathway to see, is there anything that they feel could be done from a primary care perspective? Doing simple projects like that sometimes can really change local pathways. LJ's got her hand up like she's in school. Yes, LJ.
So just then, you just reminded me of like the team working aspect that Paul spoke about quite a lot. So, you know, how he spoke about these different systems within London specifically in this case, but like there are different systems in place. The role of the PCN, the role of the CCG, the role of these new partners he's brought into the practice. And that actually, it doesn't have to be just you on this like one man mission or one woman mission to go and, you know, solve homelessness in your local area as a GP. Like, you know, you, there are teams, there are systems in place. There are so many different ways of working together and having that joint up care that he mentioned towards the end there. Yeah, I think it's a perfect example, really, of the team working in primary care.
Mary, you're on mute.
I'm on mute. You think after 2 years of doing this I'd get used to this rodeo, but apparently not. No, I was saying, yes, team working is definitely key, because I think also if you take the brunt of dealing with a vulnerable population like this, you're at a high risk of getting burnout and compassion fatigue. Especially, you know, as Paul said, there's some people that you're looking at, I just can't help them. But actually, all it takes is a kind word and maybe feeling listened to and answering that one problem of list of 20, where maybe actually you can't do anything for the other 19 things. And on the terms of sort of that compassion fatigue and feeling burnout, I guess, Kim, it was really nice that you asked him about what his highlight was and the story he told you. Was that the kind of story you thought he would be telling you when you asked him that question?
Absolutely not. That was totally unexpected. But what a great story not only of two of his patients sort of getting having a proposal in the middle of your GP consulting room, number one, but number two, to be in an LMC dinner back in the day, I guess, no longer the case, but an LMC dinner at the Dorchester, and to find one of your patients who was previously homeless now serving you your dinner. Like, what a story. Totally two left fields, completely unexpected.
And I think this episode was just a fantastic example of the joy that we can find in primary care and in general practice, and that actually there is probably a niche out there for everybody, which may be in or outside of medicine. We are hoping future episodes will be very similar to this, if we can find inspiring guests, which I'm sure we will, as we have done in the past. But again, to our listeners, if you think, oh, I know of something really interesting happening locally to me, or that there's something going on that you think I would like more trainees or first fives to know about it, please do get in touch with us. Bryn will be leaving our email address on the podcast somehow, as he does. But also, Paul has kindly agreed for his email to be on the podcast as well. So if you're interested in learning a bit more about homeless health, or perhaps even doing a locum in Westminster if you're based down south, then definitely do get in touch. But Kim, as you say, maybe send an email and you might have to try a few times. Is that right?
Oh, as Paul admits himself, he's too busy working and too busy dedicating himself to the patients of Westminster that he might not be uber responsive on the old email, but he is more than happy for people to come and join him and to kind of get interested or find out whether homeless medicine is for you. As he says, just it's not for everybody. Some people will love it. He said, what did he describe it as? He described it as Marmite, didn't he? You'll either love or you'll hate it. So definitely if you think you might be interested, then definitely go and join Paul, because I'm sure he'd love to have you.
And on that, I feel like that was a one-sided Marmite episode. I loved it all, but maybe I'm biased. But I think that's it for this episode of Somewhere in Between. We hope you will join us for what will hopefully be another fantastic episode in the future. But it's bye from me and bye from all my lovely co-hosts. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Just a quick one from me. I'm excited to see you all later. I just listened to the podcast on the way into Hillingdon this morning and it was fabulous. So much to talk about. Really, really exciting. I hope you're having a fabulous day and I'll see you all later. Bye.